It's The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Plans have been unveiled to construct a low-impact hydroelectric plant on the Ohio River at the Emsworth Dam that's intended to power all Allegheny County buildings and reduce emissions. Joylette Portlock is the Executive Director of Sustainable Pittsburgh. Joylette, welcome back to The Confluence.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here.
Joylette, Rhine Development will build the facility, which will cost an estimated $50 million. It'll create 150 to 200 construction jobs. But short and long term, what impact will this hydro plant have on our region, do you believe?
The benefits of doing an agreement like this are, you know, cost savings, risk reduction against market price increases, pollution reduction. But also, I think it's important to note that this is a change in the conversation of really improving our conception of what's possible here.
Mm-hmm. So what specifically, what kind of an impact is this going to have on our carbon footprint?
In terms of climate impacts, this is a big deal. You know, we know that moving to renewable clean energy is absolutely necessary to protect the region from climate impacts. We're already seeing those impacts in terms of heavy precipitation, heat waves, and challenges to what have been some pretty hard-fought gains in air quality.
Can you give us an idea, what do they mean by a low-impact facility?
So a low-impact facility is one that has actually been certified and evaluated for the overall impact to the environment. For instance, building a new dam would be a disruptive thing. But this, because it's built upon existing infrastructure, has really been shown to not have a big impact.
Mm-hmm. This is not the first hydropower plant being built on our rivers. Pitt is working with Rye Development on a facility at the Highland Park Dam to generate power for Pitt's campus. Aurora Sherrard from the Office of Sustainability was a guest on The Confluence. So in that announcement, Paul Jacobs, CEO of Rye Development, noted we've been sort of wasting energy that's been flowing along our rivers. So we'll be using actually one natural resource, water, to replace others, oil, natural gas, et cetera.
Right. And it is significant that this is going to be enough energy to power the county's buildings, right?
Mm-hmm. Joylette, Sustainable Pittsburgh has been advising, encouraging, maybe even nudging government officials in general to do the environmentally responsible thing. Any idea why this hasn't happened before? The Emsworth Dam is about a century old.
I think that really leadership is about having a responsibility for creating the conversation and for setting the course and for, you know, innovating in a way in order to build a better future, right? So It's not necessarily obvious when you have one mode of thinking or a set of practices in place to continue to do those things in that way. Mm-hmm. But I do think that it's important, and for this region anyway, innovative, to really be looking at our rivers as a resource in ways that impact how we are producing energy and electricity.
Joylette, how does this particular project complement others that are going on locally to reduce carbon?
Well, I think there's a lot of leadership being shown right now in different projects that are coming up. Taken together, you know, they really are starting to set a path for the region and open some possibilities into, you know, how we can build this region to last.
In making the announcement, Allegheny County Executive Rich Fitzgerald called it historic. Is it historic, or is it just another important step along the way?
Yeah, I think that projects like this and actions like this will be looked back on as a turning point, you know, in how this region is thinking about and producing energy.
Finally, the Biden administration announced goals to cut the carbon footprint of U.S. buildings by 50% by 2035. We have the Pittsburgh 2030 district and its goals. What does it take to achieve those goals? Is it an attitude, a determination? How would you put it?
I think it takes Leadership, and it takes commitment. Leadership, as we've been talking about, is really important for being able to create the conversation around those goals, for setting the course, and then the commitment at all levels of every organization and all levels of society, including individuals, is necessary to enact those changes.
There are many benefits. I mean, you have temporary construction jobs, you have cost savings, you have reduction in the carbon footprint. But does it all come down to a quality of life issue for our region?
You know, I think so. Well, maybe not all, but absolutely, that's a big part of it. I think that, you know, when we look towards what we want as a region, we want jobs, we want economic investment, we want clean air, clean water, we want healthy communities, we want thriving connections to one another. This is the kind of project that helps to build that.
Construction on the hydropower plant at the Emsworth Dam is expected to begin late this year and be completed by mid-2023. Joylette Portlock is the Executive Director of Sustainable Pittsburgh. Joylette, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you very much for having me.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Millions of dollars that had been set aside by the state for pandemic-related rent relief never made it to struggling tenants and landlords. In a joint reporting project with Public Source, 90.5 WESA's Kate Giamarisi examines what went wrong and how officials can avoid repeating mistakes with new federal assistance.
Dewan Davis lost a job on July 8th, and 2 days later, he and his landlord filled out the paperwork to try to get state help paying the rent for his Penn Hills apartment. That application to the state's CARES Rent Relief Program was supposed to be the first step towards 6 months of aid that would have covered his $610 a month rent. But, like thousands of other Pennsylvanians, he was denied assistance. He's not certain why, but he remembers how it felt.
I was crushed. I felt so dejected.
Davis is now the defendant in an eviction filing. While he waits, Pennsylvania state and local governments sit on $852 million in federal aid dedicated to rent assistance, part of the $900 billion COVID relief package Congress approved in late December. Without additional money, Davis is taking every shift he can at McDonald's and trying to keep his head up.
But it almost feels like not worthless, but like just running in place.
A Centers for Disease Control order restricting evictions plus federally funded rent relief were supposed to combine to prevent a surge of displacement. But last year's spotty efforts in Pennsylvania suggest this will be difficult. In 2020, the state's program approved about one-third of applications before it closed in November. As a result, the state spent just $54 million of the $150 million it allocated for tenants and their landlords, according to the Pennsylvania Housing Finance Agency. The remaining funds went to the Department of Corrections as Republican legislators and Democratic Governor Tom Wolf balanced the state's budget. Allegheny County managed to separately pay out more than $14 million. Still, it paid only half of its applicants. Why was it so hard to get funds to those in need? Among the state's problems, the program, which began in July, included a requirement that tenants be 30 days in arrears, and a $750 monthly cap on assistance made some landlords reluctant to participate. Bryce Moretzky is a policy director at the Pennsylvania Housing Finance Agency.
The application process was burdensome to have both a tenant part and a landlord part, and having a lot of documentation required.
By August, a number of elected officials and advocates were saying the program wasn't working quickly enough. A bill to streamline some of the process passed the Republican-controlled State House in mid-October, but never got a vote in the state Senate. Republican leaders who control the chamber did not respond to a request for comment. Democratic State Senator Jay Costa of Forest Hills is the Senate minority leader. While he's not certain, he says lawmakers prioritize the state's bottom line.
In part, probably they wanted to hold on as much as they could to resources that could be used to help balance the budget, which these resources ultimately were used for.
Advocates are urging officials to do things differently with the second round of assistance, more than $850 million directed to Pennsylvania from the federal government. Phyllis Chamberlain leads the Housing Alliance of Pennsylvania, which promotes affordable housing.
Reducing the restrictions and requirements as much as possible is just so important, so we get the money out as quickly as possible.
The pressing need for funds, combined with the state legislature's calendar, also has advocates like Chamberlain concerned. Senators and House members don't have votes scheduled between early February and mid-March. That could leave money sitting unspent instead of helping landlords and tenants. Some elected officials, including Governor Wolf, say the state will do better with the upcoming round of rental assistance. And unlike last time, they'll be forced to return any unspent federal funds. As state and local officials figure out the details, eviction filings continue. Davis's landlord, Arbor's Management, also says he has other problems in addition to the money he owes. Davis says he sees minor issues as an excuse to push him out. And Arbor's manager declined comment. In the meantime, Davis says he's still hoping for aid, exploring a potential second job, and getting involved with an anti-eviction group. Kate Giammarisi, 90.5 WESA News. This story was co-reported with Rich Lord of Public Source.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. With the latest round of statewide COVID-19 mitigation measures lifted, museums are allowed to reopen with now familiar rules: masks, limited capacity, and social distancing. The entire Frick campus reopened recently. One exhibit that visitors have a chance to see focuses on the Frick's history. Elizabeth Barker is the executive director. Elizabeth, welcome to The Confluence.
Thank you. It's lovely to be with you.
Frick Art Museum was founded 50 years ago. The Clayton home was restored just about 30 years ago. Their histories, though, go back so much farther. The Clay Frick family lived at the Clayton home for, more than 100 years ago. And the museum holds Helen Clay Frick's personal collection of fine and decorative art. Using her collection and family possessions as a lens, what do we now know about the world that Helen Frick lived in? And what kind of person was she?
I'm so glad you asked. It's one of the key stories that I think even visitors who've been to the Frick before may find something new when they return this time. This is an exhibition that really takes a look at our origin story through the lens of many of the questions we're all asking in America and around the world now. We're thinking about how organizations participate in the construction of knowledge. I think, in a sense, the way we understand history is the way other people tell it. And museums tell stories, and the stories we tell shape the way we perceive the world. And we realized that the stories we're telling, of course, aren't completely objective. Not that we approach it with a sinister motive, but all of us as human beings exist in our time and place, in our societies, with certain beliefs, conscious and unconscious. And this felt like an ideal moment for us to think a little bit about our founder, this extraordinary woman, Helen Clay Frick.
So what kind of person was she?
I wish I had met her. I think she was fierce. In many ways, she was an extraordinary feminist, but she would have been the last person to espouse that. She very much believed in the Victorian values around what it meant to be a well-bred woman, the kinds of values that she grew up with. But she led a life that wasn't the one I think her family had planned for her. Mm-hmm. She never married. She didn't have children. In fact, she spent much of her life having what we would think of now as a career. She was an extraordinary philanthropist who inherited a tremendous fortune. Mm-hmm. When her father passed away, she became the wealthiest unmarried woman in the United States.
She did live a privileged life in a time that didn't grant everyone those same opportunities. How is the museum acknowledging that?
The exhibition, for which all credit is due to my wonderful colleagues, Don Reed Breen, Melanie Grove, and Kim Cady, They've really pulled together a series of open-ended questions, and they talk about what it meant for Helen Clay Frick to grow up with such extraordinary privilege at a time when very few people lived as the Frick family did. Even reflecting on the ratio of 3 or 4 servants per family member in a family that was half small children is something to think about. The exhibition asks questions about gender roles. It raises very timely and important questions about race. And it thinks about structures of power that even now continue to shape our public institutions. I really hope folks will have the chance to come and see it for themselves. If people are not feeling comfortable yet coming out, there are many ways to engage with the show online, too.
Okay. Museums often bring attention to the work of artists and collections, but this exhibit is really shining a light inward on the museum itself, the history of its founder. Was that at all uncomfortable?
Yes, and it was intentionally uncomfortable. You can't fix a problem you won't own. And this show has some really poignant examples. I might share just one. Visitors to the house may not often pause to see a couple of photographs that hang in a quiet location. Those photographs show Henry Clay Frick Jr., the Frick family's son who died in infancy, and their post-mortem photographs of this little boy in his christening gown being held by the family's African-American nursemaid. She's dressed immaculately in the most respectful and respectable Victorian fashion of the day. We've presented those difficult photographs in as sensitive a way as we could imagine. There's a warning so that people won't be taken by surprise, and they're displayed in a way that gives a little privacy for the viewer, because it's a very emotional thing to look at these pictures. But they're also presented in a way so that as you round the corner after seeing these incredibly moving photographs that make you question the role of the woman holding the infant. She must be in a position of trust, but there's also a way in which she's part of the accoutrement of the family's wealth in the way in which she's presented.
Elizabeth Barker is the executive director of the Frick. Thanks so much for being with us.
It's been a pleasure.
And for today, that is The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. You can find more from this and past episodes of The Confluence online at wesa.fm/confluence and through your favorite podcast app. Thanks to our team, Tom Hurley, Isabel Schmaler, Lara Satsui, and Mary Lee Williams. I'm Kevin Gavin. Until next time, hope you have a good day of good news.